And welcome to the midday. I'm Norman Gilliland, and we have guests today. And guests whose music I've been listening to for must be 30 years now, I suppose. William Bolcom and Joan Morris. Welcome.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Husband and wife duo, and it was your very first recording, wasn't it?
With Joan.
After the Ball.
Yeah, with Joan, that was the first time. I'd made several ragtime recordings and also some of my other music as well. But that was before I met Joan, and the next year after we made that recording.
Yep. We were kind of looking for a project, and the lady, the lady that ran Nonesuch Records, she says, well, you're doing, we had begun by doing music of the 20s and 30s. She says, well, the royalties are too much. She says, so let's go back to the turn of the century, the songs that everybody sings when the ship goes down. And I had to be persuaded because I had done an off-Broadway show called The Drunkard. We were encouraged to nudge, nudge, wink, wink. And Barry Manilow was music director. Before I met Bill, the best accompanist I ever worked with.
Really?
Oh, because he knew how to support you, how to pull back.
And so who chose the songs then for that?
Well, we chose a number of them, but Teresa Stern, who was then running Nonesuch, which I would have to say are the great days of Nonesuch, was the one who had got a few ideas. One of them was After the Ball, which is the one that was really the one that was difficult to, because you had sent it up when you're working with Barry Manilow, then you had to take it seriously, right. And you had to suddenly look at it, and people would say, what a corny story, people would say, because, you know, the story, you know, but I guess it was probably true, because I think Charles Harris had actually seen this happening.
We
even found the particular, it's in Milwaukee, it is the Turnverein, which is right in Milwaukee, and this is an old place which is still there, and they have a Ratzkeller upstairs and so on and so forth. And the very top floor was a ballroom where Charles Harris happened to be there, and he had seen a couple break up, and that's what gave him the idea for the song.
Yeah. So that is a Milwaukee song.
It's a Milwaukee song, and Joan and you and I were, Nadia Salerno.
Nadia was
doing my violin concerto there in Milwaukee. So we all went there up to the top floor, which had been burned, and I don't know if they restored it yet. And there was an old piano, so we sat down. We did After the Ball right there.
Look down from the balcony like he must have done.
It was kind of fun,
Well, it must be fun to be able to sit down and perform, you know, top grade that way, wherever you ever surprise people. You know, we hear occasionally, you know, Joshua Bell playing, what, in the Washington subway and that kind of thing.
Yeah, I know, nobody recognized him. About 3-4 years ago, Dana Joya asked if I would, he's then running the NEA, and he had, would I come and do the NEA Opera Awards? It was a new idea he had, and he wanted to have me come and give one to Carlisle Floyd, which I was very glad to do. And before that, there was a lunch in the Supreme Court building, of all things, and here we are, where the string quartet was playing, and in the group of us all lunching was Leontine Price, also going to be receiving an award, and the string quartet starts playing Visi d'Arte. And within a few seconds, she starts singing Visi d'Arte. We all shut up to listen to her. She still had the high A flat at 80 plus, I don't know what it was, tiny lady. My God, her intonation was, she was just wonderful. You know, I'll never forget that.
Yeah, it must be, as I say, it must be really great to be able to surprise people that way.
Oh,
yeah.
In an unusual setting. Before I met Bill, I had an act with a harpist, and we did go into Central Park. And, on various street corners, we'd set up, and people would stop and listen to us, and had to shoo away dogs. You know, they're always getting too friendly. But it does teach you something about when I was in college. We were encouraged to look above the heads of the audience. That's the first time when I was on the street that I looked in people's eyes. And I know this sounds like a funny thing to say, but it's like they're looking at me. You know, I guess I thought, because I was looking above their heads, they were looking above my head.
Right. When you're on stage, I guess, you tend to look to the back of the hall, and you don't really look eye contact at the
audience. And we've been doing master classes for years, and one of the things we tell them is don't do that. Look at people. And I remember once I was at the, it was a Nats convention, the teachers were singing, and I said that, and after I was finished, the old woman who had been in Manhattan school teaching for 40 years, she said, you have gone against every single thing I've been teaching for 40 years. She was very unhappy and sat down. I felt awful, but, you know, the world does change.
It does. It does. Well, let's hear some of your very diverse music.
Well, this is a fun little type. You're going to do one of the Seattle Slough Suite, which I wrote for the Pacific Northwest Ballet when it was being written by Ken.
Ken Stoll and Francesca.
Yeah, that's right. Thank you. That's why I'm so glad you're there.
Ken's marriage be saved.
This is one of those husband-wife duos where they actually supply information to each other instead of contradicting each other.
We had to.
Off-camera, that happens. Well, you know, marriage is like a three-ring circus. There's the engagement ring, the wedding ring, the suffering.
It's an old vaudeville. She collects joke books. We even went to Paul's Books here, and we're looking for joke books.
Yeah, I want to look further.
You still have decent bookshops here, whereas Ann Arbor, they're all closed. When Border went, it's impossible to find a decent show. Mm-hmm. They're all closing now. It's horrible.
It was like a black hole, wasn't it? Borders went down in Ann Arbor.
Yeah, amazing.
Well, it started there, of course.
Sure.
Yep, that's a shame.
The whole area is just heartbreaking. I don't even think about it. But you have several nice ones here. Lucky you.
You're originally from Seattle, right?
I was born there, yes.
Is there any connection between that and Seattle Slough, or is it just coincidental?
Well, that was what the Kent Stoll and Francia Russell asked me to do about it. They wanted to have a little suite of pieces for a character named Seattle Slough. I think it was danced by Darcy Kistler, somebody, a very star person. And she was all dressed up and talked dead and very nice little... and so I said, okay, I will do set dances. I want to do this all in different kinds of... Because, of course, there are three triple crown.
Right.
Yeah, and there's derby, dressage is this one. I think the one you're going to be playing.
That's right.
And the other two are... They're right there.
That's right. Preakness.
Preakness Prance.
And
the last
Belmont
hit. Belmont
Bourre.
Belmont Bourre. So I took the kind of square phrasing from these dances. I thought I would do something light and funny, and each one very carefully tied. This is like a gavotte you're going to be hearing now. So this is derby dressage. It was a very lighthearted piece. And the last minute of the last one, you hear the actual race going. Because, I mean, you know, a horse race is over a minute and a half.
That's a problem, isn't
so,
it?
Yeah, so exactly. Races. You know, it's like it's ridiculous. You know, it's much less time. It's like certain things that take much less time, and yet they've been talked about. And that's one of those cases. I can think of others, too.
You could cover the whole Triple Crown in about 6.5 minutes of music, couldn't you?
You certainly could. But they wanted a whole big piece, so I said, okay, I think I'll do set dances. I was sort of interested in square phrase and so on. But this is the Derby Dressage.
And performing the Louisville Orchestra with Lawrence Lane Smith.
Yeah, Larry's wonderful. Thank you.
That was from the three-movement suite, Seattle SLU, an orchestral suite, three dances for four-quarter time by William Bolcom, who's with me today, as is Joan Morris, who is his longtime collaborator and spouse. And we heard the Louisville Orchestra with Lawrence Leighton Smith conducting. And at 17 past 12, about 13 or so minutes away from the quiz question here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Back with Joan Morris and her husband, William Bolcom. And we should mention why you're in town, which is a very important kind of thing, because it's all part of the 100th anniversary celebration of the Priority Quartet, and they commissioned you to write. It's your piano quartet number two?
Piano quintet number two. Yeah. I've done two piano quartets, it's true, but this is now a piano quintet. I've never done a piano trio, except for a little rag one, because usually piano trio are in memoriam of somebody. But of course, at my age, there's plenty of people to memorialize. I haven't figured out the right one yet.
Well, what's your lead time? If I were to commission you to write a piano quintet number three, how long before I could expect delivery?
Oh, about 4 or 5 years.
That's not too bad.
Well, maybe, yeah. It depends a great deal on certain things I'm hanging in fire on right now. But that's, I think that's probably much the same with anybody who's made some kind of a dent in this business, such as it is.
Yeah, I mean, you have other things going on other than composing.
Well, mostly composing now since I retired from the university in 2008.
University of Michigan.
Yes, I was University of Michigan there for 35 years. I came at 35 and I retired at 70, which was just too symmetrical to resist. So, and then Joan, who'd also been teaching there in at cabaret performance, and she retired the next year, which has freed us up for lots of residencies and whatnot, and we're doing a good deal of those. Meantime, she's working on her book about, she was asked about a quarter century ago, she's been working on this book about what do you call it?
Singing popular style.
No.
Bill thought of the title, An Actress Who Sings, because that's what I started out as and what I still am.
Yeah, she's an actress who sings. A whole different, I had a whole theater career, which was very important to me in my early years. I wrote three operas for actors,
sure,
including people like Barbara Harris and Alvin Epstein and William,
Redfield.
Wonderful. Yeah, Redfield, who was in The Fantastic Voyage, all first class, wonderful actors and singers, great people. George Gaines, who was actually trained as an opera singer, but also a lot on television. And he was also in Tootsie and a number of things. And so I had all these great people to work with.
Uh-huh.
And because at that point in the 60s, you were not terribly happy with the way a singer sang English. Now, of course, they're much better, at least somewhat better, but enough so that you can actually pick people that you can actually understand when you sing. It never used to be possible.
And a lot of times that is important. Later, I cannot resist playing Black Max.
Yeah.
Oh.
Which is this wonderful blend of piano and words,
mm-hmm,
and the singer who actually makes these difficult words but very entertaining words,
right,
clear.
Which recording do you play? Do you play the one that Joan and I did?
Or? I don't have that one.
One thing I have always done, and we've always done this anyway, look up our website. Send us your orders, because as a public station, we're perfectly glad. We have extra copies of things. We are perfectly glad to give them to you.
All right.
Please do that.
And we've always done that, and we don't expect any payment. We're just, there they are for you to prize into whatever you want to do.
Well, I'll be happy to do that.
But we'll be glad to know. This is a recording that Joan and I made, I think, 2003, and this was at a live performance at the Fleet Theater, which is this wonderful place, which is run by Sigourney Weaver and her husband, Jim Simpson. And And we've done these since they were written. You know, most of them were written for you, except for the three I wrote for Barbara Harris, except the, you know, I've had a long theater career. And then finally, I was sort of drafted into doing operas for Lyric Opera, and three of them I did there, McTeague.
Sure. Frank Norris, yeah.
Yeah, and I did that with Robert Altman as the director. And the second one was I did with, it was actually working with Arthur Miller. We did A View from the Bridge with Frank Galati directing.
It'd be a great opera.
And it was, it's been done and done. Every year it's been done, a lot of places. I mean, since 1999 when it came out. And then the third one was one called A Wedding, which is from Bob Altman's movie A Wedding, which we made into a comic opera. That's been done a lot. Most recently was done at Oberlin, wonderfully for students, but it was also done for Lyric. All three were written for Lyric. And I had the great pleasure working with some of the best people in the world. And they all died the same year at the Bob Altman, Arnold Weinstein, my longtime collaborator, and Arthur Miller, all the same year. So I'm sort of bereft of.
Arnold Weinstein, of course, he's the one who wrote the lyrics for Black.
Black Max and all the other things, and all my operas for Lyric, and the ones that I did for a theater. So we worked together 45 years.
Great theatrical poet, I think, is how he described himself.
Yeah, he always said he's theater poet. He was much less interested in being published, but to be performed. Which I'm thankful to say is being performed all over the world. Unfortunately, he's not here to enjoy it.
Well, on the other hand, that is something that we would want to be performed, not just published. This is your eighth symphony we're going to hear the finale from?
This is... I don't know. You must have a recording of the Songs of Innocence and of Experience.
We do, yes.
Well, this was, of course, my great piece that I worked on 25 years, built on the Blake poems from Songs of Innocence and
Pulitzer
Experience.
Pulitzer Prize winner.
Well, it won 4 Grammys. Yeah. two for the choral director and one for me, but never mind. That's all right. It's fine. Yeah. He deserved it. We had to nudge him to do it. Now, of course, my heavens, he's a fan because he really won a lot of kudos for that. But anyway, I'd always been interested in the rest of Blake, and the prophetic books are these very naughty, difficult things that people have great trouble
with. Oh, sure, you know,
trying
yes.
to, and I remember trying to puzzle through them a great deal and still have. Well, James Levine, whom I've known since he was a boy, we were together at Aspen. In fact, I've worked with Dennis Russell Davies and Jim and Leonard Slatkin since we were all young. And he said, I want you to do a choral symphony. He says, well, okay, finally, I'm going to have a chance to set some parts of the prophetic books of Blake. And they come from various sources. The first and the last movements are from The Marriage of Heaven and Hell. And what you're going to be hearing is part of the finale of the Eighth Symphony with the Boston Symphony under Levine, and the chorus, the Tanglewood Festival chorus under this phenomenal man, John Oliver, who got everybody to do everything by memory. And to see a whole chorus not turning their books, it's amazing to hear them do it, and they're very proud of it, and it's a very difficult part. So this is the ending with the big peroration at the end. This is the second, last 5 minutes, I guess, of what we're going to hear from this whole thing. And the big ending, which is what I wanted to be sure we got to hear, is called, you know, the last words are, for everything that lives is holy, which is, of course, that's what I really believe in. So anyway, here we are with the end of the Eighth Symphony.
Thank you.
some powerful stuff there. The finale of your Eighth Symphony, the Eighth Symphony of William Bolcom. Boston Symphony, James Levine, and chorus, of course, and references to or text from William Blake?
Yeah, the prophetic books.
Which, as you say, well, one of the latter-day critics of Blake referred to his obscurantism and rant.
Well,
some of it is, but not
well,
all.
Well, some of it is actually, I think he's like Gertrude Stein. They make too much sense. That's why it's hard to deal with them.
Well, some of them are very, London 1802, which is not one of the Innocence and Experience, but boy, has he come right out and say what's wrong with the state of mankind in that year.
Oh, I wander through each charter street. That is from the Songs of Experience.
Oh, is it? Okay.
Oh, yes, that's all right in the middle of Songs. Terrible. And I did it like a kind of a rock number. And that was all the fun things that I could pull all these things. But, I mean, what happened is I would do something that was suggested to me. I didn't say, gee, I'm now going to do something. I thought that would be arbitrary. But I was surprised at the things I was drawn into by setting that thing.
You said once the poem told you what it wanted
exactly.
to be.
Exactly.
Oh, that's the
best. I always do it. I always take the lead of the poet.
Well, you know, this is not exactly family show material here, Mr. Bolcom, but the words are so clever and the description is so vivid that it's just wonderful for any setting, I would say.
This will be one of the cabaret songs that I wrote with Arnold Weinstein, and it has a great deal to do with Arnold's background. When I first met him, I had come back from Paris. I had to leave because of the draft, and they set up a whole... Arnold knew all the painters and all the artists in that period in the early 60s in New York. Was a very tight group of people, all the way from Edward Albee to Larry Rivers to Willem de Kooning to Jed Freilicher to Frank O'Hara to John Ashbery, all people who were very important. They were all tight friends. Lieber and Stoller, whom I still am close friends. Jerry just died last year. And all were very much interactive and so on. One day, he was over, Arnold, to see Bill de Kooning in his studio. And what had happened is that de Kooning's brother had come to visit him. They had not seen each other for 30 years. And since most Dutch people speak better Dutch and better English than we do, for Arnold's benefit, they decided to describe what it was like to be young in Rotterdam. Uh-huh. Arnold took notes. And so this is the Song of Black Max as told by the de Kooning boys. And I hear that's now going to be Nathan doing it. Nathan Gunn, who was marvelous.
That's right, Nathan Gunn.
There was a recording that Joan and I made of the cabaret songs from, it's on Centaur, live performances in 2003, I believe. And so, and we've run them, you know, we premiered them all, and except for the ones that three that Barbara did.
We'll get that version for next time, but this is this will quite do in the meantime.
Oh, right?
This,
yes. This Nathan's
version
wonderful.
Of Black Max by William Bolcom.
He was always dressed in black, long black jacket, broad black hat, sometimes a cape, and as thin as rubber tape, Black Max. He would raise that big black hat to the big shots of the town, who raised their hats right back, never knew they were bowing to Black Max. I'm talking about a night in Rotterdam, when the right night people of all the town would find what they could in the night neighborhood of Black Max. There were women in the windows with bodies for sale, dressed in curls like little girls in little dollhouse jails. When the women walked the street with their beds upon their backs, who was lifted up his brim to them? Black Max. And there were looks for sale, the art of a smile. Only certain people walk the mystery mile. Artists, charlatans, vaudevillians, men of mathematics, acrobatics, and civilians. There was knitting needle music from a lady organ grinder with all her sons behind her. Marco, Vito, Benno, was he strong, though he walked like a woman. And Carlo, who was 5, he must be still alive. Ah, poor Marco had the sif.
And if you didn't take that terrible cure in those days, you went crazy and died. And he did. And at the coffin, before they closed the lid, who raised his lid? Black Max. I was climbing on the train, one day going far away to the good old U.S. of A. When I heard some music underneath the tracks, standing there beneath the bridge, long black jacket, broad black hat, playing the harmonica, one hand free, to lift that hat to me. Black Max, Black Max, Black Max.
I was telling one of my cohorts yesterday that if Edward Gorey had written music, it would sound like that.
Well, he was one of that group. I know him then, at that time, too.
Is that right?
Oh, sure. Uh-huh. Virgil Thompson, they were all a very tight group. They all stuck together. Frank O'Hara, the great poet, who was in those days assistant curator of the Museum of Modern Art, would call us all pretty much every evening, and he'd say, there's a poetry reading. Be there. There is an opening. Be there. And we all would show up. And the night before a showing would open at MoMA in New York, he would have us all come just to see it when it had all been hung and before the crowds came. And then Joan and I did a little program at MoMA, and there just that next day they're going to be putting on a new, who had been at Frank Stella, and then he'd become a maximalist after having been the minimalist. And so we were going through this whole thing the night before while we were waiting to perform, and all I could think of being there with Frank and all our friends. Mm-hmm. Well, it was an amazing time.
That's your Paris in the 20s.
Except I'd been in Paris in the 60s. Yeah. And so I came to New York, 20s, which was, that was a hot time in New York. It really was. Yeah.
And before I let it slip entirely, I will sprint through some of the things that are going on in conjunction with William Bolcom's visit to Wisconsin. This is all, again, part of the celebration of the 100th anniversary of the Pro Arte Quartet, for whom he has written a piano quintet number 2. In fact, I'll start with the fact that that is going to be performed, the world premiere will be performed by the Pro Arte Quartet with Christopher Taylor, piano, and it's, let's see, Saturday night, 8 o'clock, at the Union Theater. That's the world debut of the piano quintet number 2 of William Bolcom. Also, Webern and Mio and Mozart are represented. And the Mozart will feature, along with the Pro Arte Quartet, violist Samuel Rhodes, one of the greats of our times.
Wonderful.
Well, let's go back to, what must have been, what, about 1981 or something?
No,
like
74
that
Joan and I did the ball.
Okay, we didn't get it later.
Well, you got the LP?
Yes, it was the LP.
It's strangely enough, it's still selling.
Strange at all. It's great stuff.
But you know, it's rare to have anything sell that long. Yes. But it's still, it's not enough to put in your eye, but it's still selling. that was the thing that Tracy Stern and Nonsuch said we should do, and we put the thing together, and we didn't know it was going to make such kind of a hit it did.
Well, let's hear one of those hits. Gosh, I'm torn. There are so many of them. There are 20 of these greatest hits from about 1895 to 1905. After mm-hmm. the ball, you know, by the way, I think was that the first sheet music to sell a million copies? Do I remember that?
5 million copies.
Huge.
Before the turn of the century. Yep. Yeah. John Philip Sousa played it at the World's Fair in 96, something mm-hmm. like that, and over and over and over. And people were always coming up and handing the piece of paper. Charles K. Harris thanked him for doing it, and a lady came up and handed it. Sure enough, it was for After the Ball. It was just the chorus is just that tune is so beautiful.
All right, you've talked me into it. Let's do that one.
Oh.
The title song from the 1974 album After the Ball, featuring my guests today, mezzo-soprano Joan Morris and pianist and composer William Bolcom.
Have you corpses leaving after the stars are gone. Many a heart is aching. If you could read them all, many the hopes that have vanished after the ball. Bright lights were flashing in the grand ballroom. Softly the music playing sweet tunes. There came my sweetheart, my love, my own. I wish some water, leave me alone. When I returned, dear, there stood a man kissing my sweetheart as lovers can. Down fell the glass pet, broken, that's all, just as my heart was after the ball. After the ball is over, after the break of morn, after the dance is leaving, after the stars are gone, if you could read them all, many the hopes that have vanished after the ball. Long years have passed, child, I've never wed. True to my lost love, though she is dead. She tried to tell me, tried to explain. I would not listen, pleadings were vain. One day, a letter came from that man. He was her brother, the letter ran. That's why I'm lonely, no home at all. I broke her heart, pet, after the ball.
Nostalgic listening to that after all these almost 40 years?
Well, we were very different people then. We weren't even married yet. But, well, in fact, it's very funny. When I took the job, I had to deal with an outstanding divorce problem. And we got to the University of Michigan because I got this very nice job. I'd been out there for several residencies. And the Faculty Wives Club called you.
And I said, well, I'm not married to Professor Bolcom. I said, I guess I'm a faculty mistress. And click, you know.
And we finally
even
got
then,
married.
Huh?
Oh, UB Blake was the one who kept after me every time I talked to him. When are you going to marry that girl?
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, our mothers had given up, you know. So.
Oh, he came out to Ann Arbor. We got married, Catholic priest, because I was raised Catholic.
Unitarian Church, though.
And UB played the wedding march in ragtime.
Oh,
and
that's
mom
fantastic.
Did a little cakewalk down the aisle.
It was a great moment.
Boy, he was certainly durable, wasn't he?
Oh, gosh. We learned a lot
years?
From him. He taught us so much about ending songs, you know.
Oh, no, I consider my last great teacher. He was also what's important about about him was he never made a big line between performing and composing. And I think a lot of the problem of much of our time recently is that there's been one. A lot of the people at the University of Michigan, we actually would pick them sometimes, if they sustained their performing abilities, because I think that does help the music. Most people that are, two cases I can think of are people becoming quite well known now, Derek Brummell and Gabriella Elena Frank. She's a wonderful pianist, and Derek is a world-class clarinetist, and it has helped their music a great deal.
Oh, yeah, because you sort of know it from the inside out.
Well, sure, mm-hmm. And you can talk to performers in an entirely different way.
Well, let's hear some of your, this is what won you all those Grammys.
Yeah.
How many?
There were four for the recording.
Wow, fantastic. And this is, we've mentioned Pass Him during the hour, Songs of Innocence and of Experience, the text all by William Blake, the English poet of the, 1757 to 1827, if
yeah.
I remember right.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And still stumping a lot of people, but keeping a lot of English professors employed.
Well, I think so.
Mm-hmm.
It was, you know.
It's fascinating stuff and beautiful in many
cases.
I fell
in love with him when I was 17, and I still feel very close to his whole cosmology, I have to say.
And so these have been rendered in terms of, what would you call this genre?
I've been trying to figure out what the right word for it is. Not an oratorio. I finally decided it was like a symphonic cycle. And I've done actually other one on what's called the Whitman Triptych, three big Whitman poems, which were done for Marilyn Horne. But this is, I think, if I had to think of a tight name for it as a set, it's like a symphonic cycle, big cycle. I suppose closest to something like the Gorleder or Schoenberg or something. But I don't know what else to call it. But I mean, what happened is that the poem suggested the styles to me, and all of a sudden I found myself doing surprising things. If you want to play this Shepherd at some point, there's a country and western. Because I don't even like country and western usually, but for some reason it wouldn't go away. I went on the principle, if it didn't go away, I'd use it, and then I'd have to deal with the consequences, which is how the whole piece was built.
Well, it seems to have worked pretty well. This is from very early in this symphonic cycle.
Right.
The echoing green from the Songs of Innocence.
Thank you.
from the Songs of Innocence by William Bolcom. And at the risk of being brusque, let's accommodate the Graceful Ghost, one of your most famous rags, probably the most famous of all your rags.
Oh, by a long shot, yeah. Yes.
And this says John Murphy. Famous rags of our time, The Graceful Ghost, as written by my guest today, William Bolcom, who's here also with Joan Morris, one of our great singers, and John Murphy was the pianist there with The Graceful Ghost rag. Pleasure having you with us today.
Same here, Norman. Thank you.
Look forward to the big world premiere Saturday night at 8.